We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford with my co-host Dan Schwartz, the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise.
Hi, Dan. How you doing?
I'm good. People often don't see nutrition and education as being friends or as being related. They can be good friends. They can be relatives, but but they don't get the connection. So I want to start with a study. This was done by Scott Rizel, one of our colleagues at Stanford. And he went into China, an impoverished region of China, and half the children got to take iron pills and half didn't. And then a year later, they look at their grades and even their IQ. And it turns out if you've taken these iron pills, it helps. You do better in school because they low iron. So the question was, why did he run this study?
Because if you're hungry, you can't learn, right? I mean, I think, right, so I don't know. Is that
so
a dumb answer?
These were iron supplements. No, the answer was he was trying to convince the Department of Education that nutrition was their responsibility by showing that changing their diet affected their academic outcomes.
So not the parents' responsibility. This is on the school to feed the children well. If you want to maximize your education outputs, you have to feed your children
well. Very impoverished area.
Yeah.
You know, very rural. And so they didn't have enough iron in their diet. So parents probably couldn't fix this on their own.
Interesting. I can tell you that when I am hungry, there is no learning that goes on. When I am hungry, I mean, my family actually has they have a word for this.
Okay, right.
This is, do you know the word hangry?
Hangry. I can guess.
It is a combination between hungry and angry. That's one of the nicer words that they have for that. And if I'm hungry, they just know. Like, nothing good is going to happen. Give mom, an apple and some peanut butter because this is not going to happen without
food. I'm working on it. So, can I come up with grumpy and starving, grarving?
Grarving.
It wouldn't be as good as hangry.
We also say LBS. Term. That's our little code for low blood sugar. I mean, honestly, it really does affect – maybe it's just the kids of my family, but it sounds like it's these kids in China too. I mean, you really have to be well-fed in all ways in order to do anything well. Exercise, learn, teach, do a radio show.
I think that's right. So we've brought in the world's expert, Professor Christopher Gardner. He directs the nutrition studies at the Stanford Research Prevention Center. And we have two central questions that have guided his research. What can people eat to optimize their health? And what can successfully motivate people to make better food choices? So welcome, Christopher.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So before we get into it, I have to ask, is there any truth to the sugar high? Is this like a myth, or does that exist?
Is a sugar high and a sugar low, and everybody metabolizes it differently. So a bunch of people have a sugar crash.
Sugar crash.
That's me.
Sugar crash. So
sugar
donuts.
Crash.
Donuts, and then boom.
But is that related to the food coma, like that feeling after you've eaten a lot of sugar, and then you're just like. Pfft.
Yeah. So metabolically, to be overly simplistic, so you have insulin that puts sugar away so that it won't go too high. And some people crank out the insulin at the first sign of glucose, and they put too much glucose away, and then you fall asleep.
Huh.
Whereas other people don't crank out as much insulin, and it perks them up for a while. So frustratingly, it's different for everyone. So there is a sugar high and a sugar low.
That's interesting.
And you
I did not
see,
know that.
Okay, so this is why nobody wants to be the teacher who teaches the class after lunch. You never want to give a lecture after lunch. Seriously, because you have these people in food coma. Exactly. Christopher's yawning into the microphone, if you can't see that, right? You just don't want to be that constant class after lunch.
So can I just give him carrots or something?
So the nice thing there, it's a slow release. So carrots basically break down to a lot of sugar, large portions of it. But you have to get through the fiber. You got to chew it a bunch. It's got different components, not just glucose. And so it'll break apart and slowly slip into your bloodstream and, in theory, keep you more even keeled.
So my mom giving me a lunch of nothing but Twinkies was probably a mistake.
Yeah, okay. And look where it got you.
I had that too. No, wait, listen. I had peanut butter jelly sandwich on white Wonder Bread. I had a Twinkie, a Ho-Ho, or a Ding Dong. Those are bringing back memories, right?
Ding dong, yes.
I had chips, and I probably had a juice box or a chocolate milk. That's a lot of sugar. This is why I crash.
Yep. So we're amazingly resilient. You can get by on a lot of different things. And then if you look at test scores in the U.S. compared to some other countries? Is that because of educational pedagogical reasons, or is it partly because of our crappy Western diet? It's up for grabs.
That's a good question.
So you right now are trying something in cafeterias to see if you can help people eat more healthy. I don't know why getting people to eat healthy is so tough, but you've got a new way to get after
because
this.
Because ding-dongs are so good. What do you mean, why is it so tough? It's pretty self-explanatory to me.
Well, the flip side of that is, so when we tried to make healthier food for a while and put it in nutritionists' hands, it tasted like cardboard.
Yes.
So let's make sure we have all the proper nutrients and get as much fiber as you can. We don't need any herbs or spices for that. We just need the isolated nutrients that go into the metabolism because I've studied books. Turns out people like taste, convenience, all kinds of things other than health. So, yeah, the thing that we're doing in dining halls is really fun, and it really came about after years of my own frustration. So quick little background. I was a philosophy major who wanted to have a vegetarian restaurant. By mistake, I got a PhD in a faculty position. So exceeded.
That's good. You would have been a taxi driver if you'd gone the philosophy route.
All my expectations, ran NIH-funded studies, published things, and shared them with the public who didn't follow what I was finding.
Mm.
I thought, what?
You mean they didn't listen to you?
I did great science. How come you're not doing that? And they would look me in the eye and say, well, I don't cook. And I don't shop, and I buy convenience food and things like that. And so I wasn't really getting at the taste hook. Mm-hmm. So in the last 5 or 10 years, I've been hanging out with more chefs, and I've been finding chefs who want to be part of the solution, not the problem. So there's a group, the Culinary Institute of America, which has a main campus in Hyde Park, New York, but a satellite campus in St. Helena above mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. And as industry leaders, they've been telling folks, you know, we really need to stop the progression of chronic disease here, and we can make great tasting food. Why don't we make unapologetically delicious food? Wouldn't you like to have unapologetically delicious food for lunch?
That sounds great to me.
And in the background, we'll make it healthy and environmentally sustainable, but let's lead with taste. Hmm. Let's stop saying, you know, I've got this thing and it's nutritious and it's almost as good as the thing you like. It was very apologetic, right? And so this guy's idea, the chef, was, let's lead with unapologetic deliciousness. And so this is basically the CIA and Harvard and Stanford and some others coming up with a chef board, a scientific advisory board, and a business board to make sure there's sound financial backing for this.
Good.
So it would be sustainable. And so your point about cafeterias. So we now have a group called the Menus of Change University Research Collaborative, and 25-plus universities across the country have agreed to use their dining halls as living laboratories, where the simple concept here would be that dining operators from the different schools would say, yes, we will allow students to be a little bit disruptive and come in and do tests in the dining hall with signage, framing of messages, and things like that. If faculty like you, Christopher, will mentor the students to do good research, and what we'll try to do there is we will try to make great tasting food, and you study it and see if it works.
Brilliant.
And so these will be,
I want to taste it. I want to be a subject.
Quote, unquote, living laboratories. And so we can do design school thinking like Stanford likes. So you could just go in the dining hall and do an experiment this week, learn from it, change it and do it next week, and try to replicate it in Texas, in Montana, where we have other universities on board.
Brilliant.
This is Schools In with Dan and Denise. We are speaking with Christopher Gardner, who directs the nutrition studies at the Stanford Research Prevention Center. Tell us, Christopher, an example from that study. What have you learned as you tried to get people to eat healthier foods through the cafeteria line?
So an interesting concept that really has caught on with the chefs, which is challenging them to make the most of their craft, is this concept that we call the protein flip. So the standard American diet has some meat smack dab in the middle of the plate. It's either pork or steak or chicken breast. And then there's something on the side. Oh, yeah, there's some condiments or some veggies on the side. So the idea is that the veggies would be at the center of the plate. And maybe not just veggies. Maybe it would be some fabulous quinoa salad with strips of chicken or strips of beef, but not a big slab of beef. And so the protein flip would be the entrees would have less meat, not be vegan or vegetarian, less meat, but take advantage of global cuisine, culture, fusion dishes, spices and herbs. And the chefs are tasked with this protein flip. And so let me be even more specific and talk about a mushroom-beef blend. So overly simplistically, if you're cooking a hamburger in a dining hall setting for the sake of public safety, you have to cook it well done. Can't cook it rare. So it ends up being kind of dry.
Yeah, really. Not
Turns
good.
Out if you displace some of the meat with mushroom has this umami flavor to it. It has moistness. And so an original test was done at UC Davis, which is another one of our partners. They made some carne asada and some beef tacos, substituting in some mushrooms for the beef. And the students preferred, or the raters of this test preferred the mushroom beef blend to the beef. So now we're tasking the chefs at the different universities, how could you incorporate this into your meals? It will be healthier, and with less red meat, there's also an environmental sustainability impact. So it's doing three things at once.
I'm very impressed.
So do you remember going through the buffet in college?
Oh, yeah. It was disgusting. The food was not good, and there were things that they would say. Well, they would. I just remember this one thing called guacamole. It wasn't guacamole. I mean, we live in California, and they should have had it with real avocados, but it was like this green soup that they called guacamole. It was disgusting. And there were things called, I remember, turkey tetrazzini. It's also really gross and creamy. I mean, they were like cooking like from the 1950s for us in college. And I did not go to college in the 1950s.
So I always thought this was an issue of cost. In my high school, I was raised in Los Angeles. We had a vending machine that gave oranges, navel oranges. And they were like the best oranges in the world. And it disappeared. And my assumption was it was just too expensive to have these kinds of ingredients. Is that the case for what you're proposing? Or if times change, beef isn't the cheapest, chicken's not the cheapest thing? And
oh, well, it's a mixture. I mean, the true cost of food is really mixed up in the U.S., so tied up with taking the raw product, which didn't cost very much, and bringing added value by tweaking it, adding additives, preservatives, colors, things like that. If you really just went back to staple foods, it's not that expensive if you make simpler recipes. So that's a much more complicated question.
You can do it.
If you go back to grains and beans and bulk foods, that's the way people ate a long time ago. That was much less expensive.
And you also have this whole concept of what will children eat. Like, so forget college when they're older, but maybe even more set in their ways. But you've got, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old who only eat noodles or don't eat anything, you know, if it touches the other thing. And, you know, that's a whole other set that you've got to deal with.
So can we bring that into farm camp?
Let me just say one thing that folks are listening to Schools In with Dan and Denise. We are speaking with Christopher Gardner, and we are about to hear about farm camp to get kids to eat better, better nutrition for better learning.
So there's a partner we have, Full Circle Farm in Sunnyvale, that has an 11-acre organic farm on the grounds of a middle school. And they actually have the kids come out. They have a garden-based education, and many schools have that. And that part alone is fabulous. My kids are in an elementary school with a bunch of vegetable beds. And when they tend them and harvest them, they're much more likely to put them in their mouth if they were connected to them that way. So we have a summer farm camp when school's out. And we have 25 or so kids come out 5 weeks in a row. And Stanford undergrads are the counselors / field researchers. They don't tell the kids. And they're kind of looking at the barriers to what the kids have for eating something other than Cheezos and Weezos or whatever they are. And they do. They tend, they harvest, they chop. We give them sharp knives. We turn on stoves and they cook them and they saute them. Every Friday is Pizza Friday. And for Pizza Friday, we put tomato sauce on a homemade crust. And then you have to cover it with what you picked. And it's a parent day. And the parents come and they say, wait, this can't be possible. My child only eats Cheezos and Weezos.
Right.
And then the kid devours the whole pizza. And with tears in their eye, the parents say, what happened? I say, well, I mean, part of it is a connection to the food that they weren't getting. So anytime there's a school garden-based system or any one of these other opportunities like we have at farm camp, we're really interested in getting young kids to do that. And in fact, the Stanford STEP program incorporates now a garden-based education module that I believe Jesse Kuhl helped to introduce.
So that Stanford STEP program is the Stanford Teacher Education Program. It sounds like they're teaching teachers how to incorporate a garden into their lessons, even if you don't have 12 acres, right? What do you do?
Because one of the reasons that I love, and I'm sure a lot of people are taking advantage of it, but more could be taking advantage of it. So you can do math in the garden. And you can do social studies, and you can do language, and you can do biology. There's so many things you could do with food. So if you had to feed this many people, how many would you have to grow? How long would you have to plant it in advance? How much land would you need? So there's a lot of things that you can do with food. And then you can, I call it stealth nutrition. So in the process of saying we're only going outside to do math, but sure, if you really want to pick that snap pea and eat it, because we were measuring that, go ahead and eat the snap pea. And son of a gun, they just devoured all the snap peas because they were doing math in the back of the school.
Love it.
So your theory is don't tell people this is good for them. Make it so they enjoy it.
Thank you. Yes. We're trying to flip that because that was backfiring. Let me give you a great Culinary Institute of America example where they had counseled a restaurant to make healthier meals, and they were so excited that they had them. And by mistake, somebody had made the menus before they got to put the little heart healthy sign next to the new menus and said, I can't afford to redo them, so we'll just serve them. And they sold really well. And a month later, they got to remake the menus. They put the heart healthy sign next to them, and those items tanked.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
They assumed, because they were promoting it as health, that there was some taste that was compromised, much as some companies have tried to make a low-sodium product.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the assumption is bland, so I won't buy it.
Well, wait, sometimes that assumption is fair. I have tried some of the low-sodium products, and they are not as good as the full-sodium products.
And so that's why we had a really fun collaboration with some Google chefs a while back, and it was a sodium reduction program, but we build it as a flavor profile enhancement experiment.
Good.
And so they substituted other – it's not just that they took out the sodium. They got other herbs. And so when we have these kids in the garden, part of what they make with their pizza is they're not just putting veggies on. They're putting different herbs, and they're making herb teas and things like that.
So the thing that's exciting to me is that you can have healthy food, but that they also can taste good, and your kids might even eat it. And I'm just wondering for folks thinking, okay, but my school doesn't have a garden and I don't have the time to do all of this cooking. So perhaps after the break, we can come back and talk. This is Schools In with Dan and Denise. We are going to be back with Christopher Gardner, who directs the nutrition studies at the Stanford Research Prevention Center, with more on how to get your kids to eat healthy. Next on Sirius XM Insight 121.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Christopher Gardner about nutrition studies. We just heard about a wonderful farm that schools use to get kids to eat more healthy foods. And I think we were going to talk about some tricks, right, Dan?
Well, I think we're going to talk about guilt.
Oh, my gosh.
So I was a very busy single dad. And I needed to work Friday and Saturday nights. And so Friday night, I would get my kid at McDonald's and a videotape. And Saturday night, I'd get him a pizza and an arcade game. Should I still feel guilty about this? Or is this like, the other nights he ate okay.
Wait, I think I can alleviate your guilt. I had two parents at home, one of whom did not work full time, and we still every Friday and Saturday night had McDonald's and pizza. That was a thing. And then we went to Baskin Robbins. I mean, it was really we were just talk about sugar high. So Christopher's going to help both of us get out of this mess.
Or make us feel more guilty.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
No, and the business school. So it really is all balance.
Yeah.
So as long as you're eating a balanced diet, but a lot of kids aren't eating a balanced diet. They're really eating mostly junk food. And so it's fun being on this campus. There's lots of innovative people trying to make new products, whether they be snack products or convenience products. I mean, in the whole food industry right now, we have this casual restaurant, this fast casual, where it's not quite as cheap as McDonald's, but it's almost as inexpensive, and it's fast.
So this is like Chipotle?
Yeah, exactly. So they have some great options there, and they give you the options. You don't have to just do this one thing. You can personalize it. So if they're making tasty things for the kids, that's the way to hook them. It's got to taste great.
So what do you do with a kid who says, no, not even going to try?
So in the food world, it really takes 10 to 15 times of trying a food before you like it, not two or three.
Oh.
Yeah, so if they try it once or twice. So a lot of things that I did as a parent, because I have four boys, and what I would do is just slowly over time serving something, like to get them to – my kids will eat salad – I would just put a leaf or two of lettuce on the plate with everything else, and then two leaves, and then three. Or one of my favorite tricks was my bell pepper trick, where I started doing it on myself where I cut up red, yellow, and orange bell peppers, equal-sized portions, and I blindfolded myself. And I said, hey, kids, I wonder if I can guess what these are. Put them in my mouth, and I honestly was trying to guess, and I got it wrong. My kids howled with laughter because they thought I was so stupid for not being able to guess. And then the next thing they said was, because I have pairs of kids, they said, try me. Oh, okay, that's a great idea. Let me try you. Okay, I'll blindfold you. And one kid couldn't do it, and they said, I can't believe how dumb you are. I can certainly do this. Back and forth, and the bell peppers were all gone. And did that, and the next time they didn't want to do it, and that was fine. And then another day they did. And so just going back persistently and introducing small bites of things can build up that familiarity. So,
Denise, you need to do this with like blue cheese, anchovies, the slimy mushrooms
slimy
with your
mushrooms.
Kids.
Oh, yeah, they'll just love that. That'll go over well. No, but I will say this. I sneak healthy things in where you don't know. So if I'm making hamburger, I'll do part ground turkey, and they'll never know, or meatballs. They'll never know. I'll put I'll grate up carrots and throw it into the meatballs. So there's things that if it doesn't affect the taste, you can kind of get away with it. And then smoothies have become really big right now, and you can put anything, pretty much anything in a smoothie, and they'll never know as long as they have that fruit taste to it. So that's been a good trick,
too. But if you do that, if like I have a kale smoothie and I can't taste kale, and I do that 10 to 15 times, am I going to come out wanting to eat kale?
Oh, it's a good question.
Or more so. You will have acclimated more to that taste
and
over time.
Even if I don't know it, it'll like slip in and...
I think so. That's not exactly what I study, but that's the theory behind it. It's just multiple exposures to the food.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Christopher Gardner, having a fascinating conversation about sneaking healthy food in for picky, finicky eaters and ways. Now, what do you say to the busy mom or the busy dad who doesn't have a lot of time, a lot of healthy stuff? It just takes longer to cook. Is that a myth?
Yeah. Oh, no. So really what we need is simple cooking. So we've actually, on this campus and in other places, there's a teaching kitchen collaborative going on where there's Americans in general have lost their culinary literacy. And part of the problem is there's this Iron Chef thing where, oh, my God, cooking takes forever. Well, one of the things I did with my kids was take some kind of pasta, the tubes, that are wide enough to hold some of these broccolini things. So all I do is steam the broccolini, cook the pasta, and I stick the broccolini like a tree into the pasta, and I make a little design on the plate. So there's a little bit of artistry to the work. All they ate was pasta and broccoli, and both of those were quick.
Okay, but my child would pull the tree out of the pasta, eat the pasta, and leave the broccoli on the plate. Like, how much are you supposed to be coercing your child?
Oh, no. Coercing doesn't work. And the stealth part, that's deception, doesn't work. So I actually feel like one of the things that I'm really interested in is stealth nutrition, but not if it's deceptive. So let me go to college students just for a minute, and then I'll try to come back with you guys. We teach a class on the Stanford campus where we never mention health. We only talk about animal rights and welfare, global warming, and human labor abuses. And most of the students in the class change their diet for the better without thinking about health, just thinking, oh, food, it's a business. It comes from places. There's soil issues and there's human labor issues. So I'm not sure what age can get involved with that.
Interesting.
But at farm camp, we have some fifth and sixth graders who can spout environmental topics and issues. Not all of them, but some of them are open to it. And so rather than sneaking something in and tricking them, I'd much rather have them embrace different reasons for finding a way to eat them.
So I'm going to switch it up. We've been talking about nutrition in schools. I sort of want to, being a super educator, I care about everyone. And so I'd sort of like people in general, including parents, but for their kids to know about kind of the state of the art in nutrition. And from what I understand, this is gut bacteria. This is sort of the cutting edge that it will be coming down the line. It's something they should know about.
Well,
all right, what is it? What does that mean? It sounds gross and it sounds like potty humor to me, which is so Dan.
Yeah, no, not at all. Well, there's definitely a lot of potty humor that goes with that. But the basic idea is we've kind of thought that of your whole digestive tract, the part that holds the stool sample that's going to come out in the toilet is like the last place you want to look at. That's where all the waste is. Well, it turns out it's thriving with bacteria. And the bacteria are eating things that you didn't digest in your upper intestine, which is basically fiber. And so you have to feed these bugs in your colon for good health, we're finding out more and more. And they feed either on fiber or they feed on the lining of your gut if you haven't given them enough fiber.
That does not sound good.
And feeding on the lining of your gut is not good. Yeah. So I've been doing a bunch of started a bunch of human studies with a colleague on campus named Justin Sonnenberg. He's done most of his studies in animal models so far, but his evidence is compelling, and he's changed the diet of his entire family around this. And he's doubled the diversity of the bacteria in his gut. And there's pathogenic and there's healthy bacteria. He's doubled the healthy bacteria in his gut.
And so I've heard that this helps your immune system. Is this true?
That is the next link. So Stanford also has this fabulous human immune monitoring core run by Holden Maker and Mark Davis. And so one of the ideas is that we'll do these interventions in kids with food allergies. Let's think about the kids that are, you know, food allergies are just going through the roof.
Crazy. Right?
What's up with that? What's up with all the picnic tables with the allergy-free type things? It's got to be something with our food supply or maybe even our microbiome. So Kari Nadeau has this fabulous food allergy center on campus, the Sean Parker Food Allergy Center. We're going to take some of her kids, think about probiotics, which is eating yogurt and things with live bacteria, or eating fiber-rich foods, and the fiber is what the bacteria themselves eat that are already living in your gut. We don't have all the answers to this yet, but it's rapidly expanding health area of interest, and it's related to food.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So for schools to make sure the kids get the right nutrition, it is not just vitamins. It's like things like fiber and all the things that, no.
Yeah, and fiber only comes from plants. So there's no fiber in dairy. There's no fiber in meat. Mm-hmm. So we want them to get those carrots and those bell peppers and some lettuces so that it's feeding the healthy bacteria in their gut, which is, there's also a gut-brain connection.
Oh, so I know that. If I eat badly, I sleep like the worst thing on earth. I have nightmares. And
so it sounds like better nutrition leads to better education. It sounds like we can get our cafeterias to do what they need to do. We need to get legislation around that so that we get healthier food in the cafeterias. Ketchup is not a vegetable. And it sounds like all of us need to be eating much more healthy, a little bit less meat, a little bit more of the good stuff.
Flavorful good stuff.
Flavorful
and we need to hug
stuff.
A chef and bring chefs or culinarians into our school system so that it tastes good.
Thank you so much, Christopher Gardner. Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on SiriusXM Insight 121.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.